Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to new and returning listeners. I am Danica Ramsey Brimberg and your host of this episode of New Books in Irish Studies under New Books Network. For today's episode, I'm excited to welcome Dr. Tracy Collins, author of the recently published Female Monasticism in Medieval Ireland and Archaeology. Welcome, Tracy, to the podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Would you like to tell us a little about yourself?
Yes, well, I'm Irish. I'm a native of Limerick on the west coast of Ireland. And I went to college in University College Cork, studying English and archaeology. And I also stayed there to do my master's. And in 1995, I graduated and became a commercial archaeologist. So I set up my own business with Frank Coyne and was doing that work until very recently, when last June I took up a position as archaeologist in the National Monument Service, which regulates and protects the archaeological heritage in Ireland. So that's where I am at the moment.
And for listeners that are unfamiliar with your book, what is Female Monasticism in Medieval Ireland and Archaeology about?
Well, it's really all the archaeological sites in Ireland that relate to holy women. And the medieval period in Ireland dates from about the 5th century through to the 16th century. And so all the sites that are related to nuns for the later medieval period or religious women more generally for the early period, and looking at all their archaeological sites. So I have about 51 archaeological sites for the early medieval female religious, and about 65 for the later medieval. And of course, there's a bit of an overlap between them as well.
So then on the most basic level, what do the terms female monastic and then female religious mean?
Yeah, well, female religious is a very broad term. And traditionally, when we were looking at religious females, we would be thinking about nuns. But of course, in the medieval period, there were other types of religious women as well. And this female religious covers those types of people. And those people I'm thinking of are recluses or anchorites or vowesses or mystics, particularly from the later medieval period. And then female monasticism then is probably the female term. The males would be male monastics, and then female monasticism really relates to more traditional nuns that we would have seen in the later medieval period. So that's what the two terms mean in my book.
And then what inspired you to write your doctoral thesis and then this book on this topic?
Well, really, when I was coming to the end of my master's studies, I was introduced to the work of the British archaeologist Roberta Gilchrist. And Roberta Gilchrist has really led the field in studying religious women and archaeology and bringing an engendered approach to archaeology. And I was really taken with her book and then her subsequent books afterwards. So I'm a real Roberta Gilchrist fan. So I thought, what about the nunneries in Ireland? Because not many people had written about them. when I became a professional archaeologist, I was doing a lot of work in advance of development, and I would come across places where there was legends that there was a nunnery there, or it was written on a map. And I just became interested in it. And then I took up a lecturing position in University College Cork for a couple of years, and I was encouraged to pursue a PhD. And I thought nunneries would be an ideal research topic, and that's where it took off from.
I'm a major Roberta Gilchrist fan too. So, and then I'm now a fan of yours just because the book was so interesting to read. And especially as a person that does interdisciplinary research myself, I just was really excited about all the different materials. And then, which leads me into my next question of, what was your approach to the archaeological material as well as the textual material to reveal more about the female religious?
Yeah, well, I tried by taking Roberta Gilchrist's lead. I tried to be as broad as possible when looking at the archaeological evidence. And you'll know from your work as well, you have to look at the entire spectrum of evidence. So when you're looking at the medieval period, you do have the historical evidence to look to. But primarily, I'm led by the archaeological evidence. And I'd found previously that a lot of sites were written off and were told they couldn't possibly be nunneries because they were too big, or they were too small, or there was something not right about them. So I tried to take a broad approach. And if something had a local folk memory of a nunnery, I considered it, yes, that possibly could have been a nunnery for maybe a generation or two. So I tried to take a broad positive approach rather than cutting things out of the view of nuns. I wanted to bring all the evidence in.
And then how did you go about finding your sites as well as defining what was a nunnery?
The first thing was that the archaeology itself, and you'll know this from your archaeological background, that the archaeology itself is not going to tell you whether it was a male house or a female house. So we do need the historical evidence to tell us that. But the way I found the sites was there's a lot of work that's already been done. So for instance, for Ireland, we have the Archaeological Survey of Ireland, which categorises and classifies all archaeological sites in Ireland from prehistory all the way up until some 19th and 20th century sites are on the Archaeological Survey of Ireland, which is freely, publicly and freely available for anybody who would like to see it. And then there's older books, of course, and previous works. So for Ireland, it's Gwynne and Hadcock's Medieval Religious Ireland book. And Britain, of course, and Scotland, they have their own equivalent of Gwynne and Hadcock too. And then local histories were very important as well. And then mapping. So first edition 6-inch maps, which date in Ireland to the 19th century. A lot of antiquities are drawn on those. And then the subsequent editions of those maps. So when you draw all that information together, you really have a very good data set on which to start preparing for your field work then.
Perfect. And then with, you divide monasticism into sort of the two periods with your sites. You talk about 500 to 1100 AD and then 1100 to 1540 AD. How did, I guess, female monasticism evolve within those periods as well as over the long course? And then what was the most noticeable distinction between the two periods?
Well, the first thing to say is that in Ireland, we divide our medieval period into the early medieval and later medieval, but it's very arbitrary. So archaeologists, we like to categorize things and we like to put things into boxes. So there probably was a significant overlap between the early medieval and the later medieval. But for the purposes of study, we find that 12th century break is a convenient one because this is when we know from history that the church in Ireland was being reformed. So around 1100, a number of synods were held about how they were going to change the administration of the church and what the church actually looked like. Mm-hmm. And this is where we get the break from our classic early medieval sites of, circular enclosures with small churches in them. Clonmacnoise and Glendalough spring to mind. And then in the 12th century, with the reform of the church, the continental orders are brought into Ireland. And that is a watershed of how the architecture and the archaeology change, because the cloistral plan, which is the church with ranges of buildings around, surrounded by a cloister or a garden, are first introduced to Ireland. I think Mellifont in County Louth, founded in 1142, would be one of the first cloistral monastic sites to be built in Ireland. But of course, there was probably a bit of an overlap, and perhaps some of those early sites may have changed how they did things, but they might not have changed their structures. And then, of course, as another layer on top of that is in 1169, the Anglo-Normans from England and Wales come into Ireland, and they've already been through a reform of the church, and they're bringing more continental orders with them as well. It's kind of like a two-wave thing, but rather than see it as an event, the reform of the church as an event, it was very much a process. So over many years and a lot of overlapping archaeology and architecture, probably.
So then with those time periods, you make a very active choice to then not use none for the early medieval material as opposed to the later. And so why did you make that choice?
I made that choice because of the modern perception and the mental template that we have of, say, nuns in Ireland. So when people think of a nun, many people of my age would have been taught by nuns growing up. And so they have an image of what a nun would have looked like. And probably in the later medieval period, they were probably fairly similar. They had their habit and they had their veil and they were all well covered up. But for the early medieval period, we really don't know how these religious women dressed. And so in order to avoid being anachronistic, I thought we won't call them nuns for the early medieval period. We'll just call them female religious, because we just don't have the evidence that they looked the same as the later medieval period. And that's why I decided to try and make that distinction.
And then how did you, so were there, with those distinctions, how different then was thinking a bit more broadly, how different was being female religious different from that, from being, I guess, male religious?
So for the early medieval period, we don't really know. And I would think that there were independent female religious houses, so independent communities of women in the early medieval period, but they probably would have had a community of men as well. And in the larger sites like Clonmacnoise, Glendalochar, Talla and Finglas, we know already that there was communities of religious women there. So I imagine that the early medieval period, they had either mixed communities or communities in close proximity to each other. But because we don't have the excavated evidence for that I'm theorizing really on that. And then for the late medieval period, there seems to be more of a segregation, although there are a number of sites that male houses and female nunneries were actually quite close together. And so I think in particular in the 12th century, when there was a reform of the church, there was an experimental approach as well as to how these communities would have lived and worked together. But then as the later medieval period moved on from the 12th century, there seemed to be more segregation between female houses and male houses.
And then with this idea of independence and separation, it's making me think of, in the first chapter, you describe medieval nuns as being significant agents. So how influential were they within, I guess, the male-dominated world?
Well, I think, and following again Roberta Gilchrist here, she concluded, and I've concluded from the Irish evidence as well, that female religious were significant agents in their kind of more local sphere. So they weren't kind of big in the global sense of monasticism, but they were quite significant agents in their local communities. And I say that for kind of a number of reasons. Firstly, if they weren't important, they wouldn't have any patrons and benefactors to support them and support their community over long periods of time. Some of these nunneries lasted for hundreds of years. And so they were also, many of them were related. That what we do know of the history of some of these nuns were that they were related to their patrons and benefactors. So they were kind of almost like an extension of their larger families, and they helped manage land and be a burial place for their own families. And so they could remember their ancestors over time through prayer and contemplation.
And then how did that agency compare to, I guess, women that weren't necessarily nuns or female religious?
Yeah, well, some people would argue that, going into a nunnery and going into an enclosed space and being cut away from the world was a very negative thing. But you could also see it as a positive for a medieval woman, because the medieval status of women, they were very much, they were seen and recorded in history through their menfolk. So whether that would be their fathers or their husbands or their sons later on. And so becoming a nun and getting into a nunnery where you could maybe be an office holder, it was a way of probably having a profession, and you could go all the way to perhaps being the abbess or being in control of the nunnery and its assets. So you could see it kind of as a professional career as well as a vocation, in a way that you wouldn't have a professional career if you were a lay person in medieval society. You'd be probably somebody's wife.
And then how was, I guess, the female religious perceived by the church and society? You've touched a bit on it, but could you speak on it more?
Yes. Yeah. Well, there's two sides to every story. So in the early medieval period, we have, there are those historians who say that women religious women were seen in a very positive light. And so we're probably looking, the most popular would be St. Bridget, and that they were considered very positively. And then in the later medieval period, historians would suggest that nuns were not seen positively, but they must have been in a certain way, because again, patrons and benefactors were putting their time, effort and money into supporting them. So while they didn't have probably a very important role in the male hierarchy of the church at the time, they did occupy a very important position for their own families and their local communities.
And then particularly with modern ideas and a concept, we sort of have this perceived this form of rigidity with early Christianity and with monasteries and nunneries. Yet noticeably in your research, it was actually incredibly fluid and diverse. Could you talk a little bit, particularly as how it relates to female monasticism?
When I started looking at, say, later medieval nunneries, I was expecting them all to have a cloistral arrangement with the church and buildings around it. And then I realised that probably the minority of the 65 odd sites I was looking at had that arrangement. And many of them may have only had like a small church with an attached living accommodation, or perhaps it was a little house to the side. And so it seems that the ritual and performance of how they lived in their female monastery or their nunnery was very important, but the actual structures around them could be very diverse. And it would probably depended a lot on how much money their patrons actually had. So because they were, a lot of local people would have supported these nunneries, they probably didn't have the same type of money that many of the larger male monasteries would have had. But having said that, when you actually start looking and comparing the male houses with the female houses, there are many male houses which are quite small and modest and varied in character as well. So again, it comes back to Roberta Gilchrist's point that the female monasticism shouldn't be seen as deviant to the standard male house. there was a variety or a spectrum of how of buildings and the ritual and performance that they carried out and the divine office they were using every day was kind of creating this religious world around them, and the buildings and the structures maybe didn't matter so much.
So did particularly with the claustral mm-hmm. setup. I think in the if I remember correctly, with the book you mentioned that three actually did follow it. Were they then? I guess with those three, were they similar, or but what did you find? Were they very different?
Well, those nunneries which did have a cloistral arrangement, and I reckon from the archaeology and the historical descriptions I have, there was probably about 10 or 12 that would have had a cloistral mm-hmm. arrangement. And of that number, only three of them are actually upstanding in the field, so you can actually go and see them. And of those three, they're all in the province of Munster, which is in Southern Ireland. And they were all of the Augustinian order. So you would imagine that they would be all very similar. But in actual fact, they're all very different. They have their church and they have their cloister, and ranges can be identified, but they're all very different. One has its cloister on the south side, one has its cloister to the north side of the church, and then at St. Catherine's, which we'll probably talk about in a bit more detail, the church actually projected from one side of the cloister, which is a unique arrangement in Ireland, and I think there's only one example of it in England at Dartford. So it was highly unusual that the church, which had to be kept east-west, projected from the cloister in that one. So we're in the same region of the country, we've got the same order, and yet the three nunneries are very different in layout.
Continuing with the ideas of arrangement spatially and metaphorically, you talk about in the book the enclosures. And so how were the contradictory ideas of enclosure, yet you also talking about having nuns also, they couldn't be self-sufficient, if I remember correctly. How was there those two ideas resolved, both in terms of the landscape and within society?
Well, the landscape and society, I think some of them were in England. Gilchrist found that many of her nunneries were very secluded, but in Ireland, I found they were much closer to settlements. So Diane Hall, who has written a history on the later medieval nuns, suggests that they were in Ireland more closer to settlements or where their patrons lived, because it was a more secure and a more turbulent and violent place. But having said that, it was probably because they had more ties to the local community as well. So with St. Catherine's, where I did my excavations, it's in a secluded place, but yet it's very close to the medieval settlement. It's less than 2 kilometres away, and it's close to where the patron lived in Shannon Castle. So I think a lot of the enclosure is more of a state of mind than actual physical walls around places. So I have... there's very little evidence that these nunneries were surrounded by high walls, and perhaps where they did survive in, say, cities and towns, it was probably the walls were marking their land property rather than trying to keep the nuns in and people out. So I think we should look at enclosure more as a state of mind than actual a line drawn physically in the landscape, which were keeping the nuns in and keeping lay people out.
With the landscape, did the female religious or the nunneries have any power relatively as regards lands, routes, or the adjacent settlements?
Well, they would have had they would have had connections with the local settlements, and we know where several nunneries, their churches were actually parish churches. So they would have had lay people coming in and sharing their churches on a regular basis. But for Ireland, many of the nunneries seem to have been established by settlements that were already there. Whereas in England, some of the nunneries were established, say, on virgin ground, and settlements built up around them. So there was a slight difference in how foundations happened between England and Ireland. And I think that's because of the time that the reform was happening. The English reform happened at an earlier date than reform in Ireland.
And then with the, clearly talk about the uniqueness of the physical structures of each ecclesiastic sites, but were there any reoccurring features among them, at least a majority of them, or them overall?
Well, of course, in all of these sites, the church was the most important. And so the church was, in all cases, were rectangular structures. And they're all, medieval churches are always orientated east-west with the high altar in the east end. And so all of my sites would have had a church. Now, that could have been a quite large church, maybe at St. Catherine's, or it could have been a very small church. I'm thinking of maybe somewhere like the nuns' church in Clonmacnoise is very small. And so the size of the church probably reflected the size of the community and whether it was a parish church or not as well. But in general, the nunnery churches in Ireland were, they didn't have transepts. They were quite small, long and narrow, and much smaller perhaps than some of the ones that Roberta Gilchrist talks about in England. And then the cloistral sites would have had ranges around the central cloister. And then the rest of the sites, some of them have small freestanding buildings, and others have very little trace of any other buildings beside the church. And so it would suggest to me that they probably had little annex for attached accommodation, for example, at Kilmaine or somewhere like that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So what was daily life back? Granted, I know we're talking about a very gigantic period of time, but what would daily life have been like for people that were at these sites?
Well, again, for the early medieval period, we're not quite sure how they would have conducted their lives on a daily basis. But in the later medieval period, we know of several rules of the continental orders, and we would suppose that our nunneries were following those rules also, even though we don't have any of those documents written down anymore. So most of the orders, of which the Augustinian order was the most popular in Ireland, I know for Scotland and England, it was the Benedictine order that was the most popular. But for Ireland, it was the Augustinian. So they would have followed the rule of Augustine, and they would have had what's known as a divine office, or which was really the daily timetable, where they would use the church 7 or 8 times a day, and they would either have mass, or they would go in and sing and have psalms. And then they would undertake their daily, more mundane work in between those periods. And so it was probably, so they built up this ritual and routine on a daily basis. They would have had masses every day, and on feast days, they may have had more than one mass. They were remembering their patrons' anniversaries, their deaths and their birthdays. And so some days probably would have been very busy with carrying out the divine office every day.
And then this might sound like more of like a chicken or the egg question, but did daily life affect the architecture and the landscape, or did the architecture and the landscape affect daily life?
Yes, I would say yes. That is a real chicken and egg, a chicken and egg question, because I suppose the divine office would have built up from the cloistral arrangement, but a lot of my nunneries don't have that cloistral arrangement, or they only have portions of it. So I would think that it was the ritual and performance that was dictating how the structures were used. And Claudia Mohn's work of German nunneries, her work, I think it came out in 2006, is an excellent example of the variety of arrangements that you could have with buildings. And of course, Germany, their upstanding remains are really good for many of the orders, particularly the Poor Clares and the Cistercians. And what Claudia Mohn has shown is that she has every possible scenario of church and buildings and cloistral arrangements and galleries and two stories and single stories and freestanding structures. And they were all carrying out their daily divine office and their rituals and performance in all of these types of structures. So I would say the divine office and the way they lived their life probably dictated the structures that they used.
And then you'd also talk about the burial evidence within your book. So was the status or the life of female religious then reflected in their burials?
Well, for the evidence in Ireland, it's very hard to say, because the positively identified burials of nuns in Ireland are very few. In my excavations in St. Catharines, we got about probably about five burials which were female, and which I interpreted them as nuns, but because they don't have any, you know, they don't have a label on them saying I was a nun, it's very hard to actually definitively say 100% that this female burial was a nun and this female burial wasn't. And that's because nunneries also, they had a mixed community. So when you excavate, you find men, women and children buried. And their burials are not as segregated as you have in male houses. So for the purposes of my book, I identified the female burials at St. Catharines as being nuns, but they had nothing, no grave goods or associated artifacts or symbolism that would have told me that they were nuns. And that's quite, another thing about burial evidence archaeologically is that a lot of these sites have been used over a long period of time. So burials in many of the nunnery sites, they've been used, you know, long after the nunnery's gone out of use. So mm-hmm. the actual nunnery phase of burial has been destroyed or severely interfered with. So a lot of the burial evidence that I discuss, I'm looking at it in the context of the British evidence also.
Granted, I know we can't define them as such, then we have to use much more of a broad term describing them, but were they located in any particular location?
Well, there is a general trend that religious will be buried on the north side of their churches. And indeed, we did find some burials, female burials to the north side of our church at St. Catharines, but we also found there were a few children buried there as well. But in a lot of these monasteries, burials, they've consecrated, not only have they consecrated outside the church, but they've also consecrated inside the church and the cloister walkways and sometimes the cloister garden itself. excuse me. So with the burials at St. Catharines, we found them in the church to the north of the church, and in the cloister ambulatory or the walkways around where we put our trenches. Funnily enough, in St. Catherine's, we didn't find any burials in the cloister garden. And that speaks to me that they had enough burial space outside and in the church and in the cloister ambulatories that they didn't feel the need to use the cloister garden. But we know from other monastic excavations, such as I'm thinking of the Franciscan Friary in Ennis, which was used over a very long period of time. That's Ennis in County Clare, a medieval town. And there was burials absolutely everywhere when they excavated, inside the church, all around the cloister walkways, and in the cloister garden or garth also. And the burials there were in places maybe two or three people deep. So they were burying over a long period of time.
Both in your book as well as in the interview, you've brought up references to burials located both in Britain as well as the continent. How was female religious different from that of Britain and of the continent?
I wouldn't say that it was different. They were still following the divine office and doing that ritual and performance and using their church every day. But perhaps the communities in Ireland were probably much smaller than some of the ones in England and the continent. I know some communities of nuns were over 100, maybe 100 members of the community at any one time. In Ireland, I would suggest that the communities were much smaller, and maybe they had 12 or 16 individuals. But they would have been following the same kind of a lifestyle, and they would have had the mundane tasks as well of eating and sleeping in dormitory arrangements. Some of the nunneries were probably schools as well, so they had some education going on, and they would have been interacting with the local community where their church was a parish church. So it wouldn't have been. There probably would have been regional differences, but the overall pattern of female religious life was probably very similar.
And then in addition to desk-based work, you also talked about, you have other forms of evidence within your book. Would you please talk about the role that archaeological fieldwork played in your research?
Yeah, I found it, being an archaeologist, it was very important that I went out in the field. And I was surprised at some of the sites, like we mentioned earlier, about the variety of remains. 9 times out of 10, you can identify the church, but then there was quite a variety of other structures around. And in some cases, the remains, weren't great. And in other places, I was surprised at what did remain. And what's important to remember with archaeological work as well is that many of these sites have turned into burial places which have been used right up until the present day. So a lot of them have turned into kind of graveyards. And so a lot of the medieval evidence would be not as obvious as at other sites. And then over time, a lot of these sites may have been used when they were dissolved in the 16th century. Some of the nunnery sites, their stonework could have been taken away to build big houses elsewhere. Or in the case of St. Catherine's, the nunnery was turned into kind of the farmyard of a big house that was built in the 18th and 19th century. So some of these sites actually have a long period of use, well after the nunnery went out of use. And interestingly enough, a lot of them have pre-nunnery archaeology as well. So for instance, at St. Catherine's again, there was some prehistoric burials found when they were actually building Old Abbey House in the 19th century. So you can see that the landscape of St. Catherine's has been used over a long period of time. Now, whether the nuns actually knew there was prehistoric burials there is another debate altogether. But it just shows that this landscape has been used over a very long period of time.
And then how did St. Catherine's compare, I guess, to your other sites that you talk about within the book?
Yeah, well, St. Catherine's, I would argue, is probably the best preserved nunnery in Ireland because it has excellent upstanding remains. It's got its cloistral plan quite clearly still upstanding. And it was one of the few sites that doesn't seem to have been used after the nunnery went out of use. So after the 16th century, it doesn't seem to have continued as a burial place. It wasn't knocked down. The old abbey house was actually built next to it rather than destroying the nunnery itself. And so it continued to be used as a farmyard and stables. There was a handball alley built there in the 19th century. You can just about make out the remains of it. But the structure itself and its underlying archaeology remained pretty intact, I think, from its dissolution. And you can't say that about many of the nunnery sites in Ireland.
So what is, thinking of the book overall as well as your research, what is your favourite part? Or what was your favourite part to either carry out research-wise or writing-wise?
I very much enjoyed doing the excavations at St. Catherine's because I am an archaeologist and I like doing the digging. And I must have a shout out to my colleagues in Aegis Archaeology and my husband, Frank Coyne, who helped me with those excavations, and also students of University College Cork, because I ran the excavation as the department's training excavation. So I got a lot more excavating done than I would have done otherwise. And I'm very grateful to all those students, many of whom have gone on to become professional archaeologists, for doing that. But I mean, and the excavations at St. Catherine's shows what a nunnery site can, the information it can reveal, the pottery and how they would have used their buildings and the burials themselves. It really adds to the archaeological record. So I'd be very excited if somebody else would do another nunnery excavation and we can see what we can come up with.
Fingers crossed.
Yes, fingers crossed, yes.
What is the one thing that you hope your readers take away from reading your book?
What I would really like is that they would identify that the female religious, just as Roberta Gilchrist said, that they were not deviant to a male standard. Because when you start looking at the literature of nunneries over the last 100 years or so, many of them are written off because, you know, they weren't as wealthy as the male houses, or they weren't as big, or they weren't this or they weren't that. And so they kind of get written out of the picture. So it's to try and draw the female religious back into the monastic narrative again, and realize that they're not deviant to this male standard. In many cases, they were just as wealthy as the male houses when you actually analyze them. And by the same token, there was many male houses, particularly Augustinian ones in Ireland, that were quite small, just like the nunneries. So the wealth and status of these sites has nothing to do with the gender of their communities. It has a lot more, I think, to do with their patrons and benefactors. And so if the interested lay reader or the archaeologist will take that from the book and maybe look into these places in a bit more detail, I'd be very happy with that.
Do you have any future projects or anything else that you'd like to share mention on the podcast?
Well, we're just commencing a project which is based on a conference that we did in 2021 called Brides of Christ, where we looked at female religious from the very early medieval period all the way through to the early modern period. And in that we had groups of, there was archaeology and historians, medieval historians and early modern historians. And we drew together the theme of Brides of Christ. And we think it was very successful, and we're just working on the edited volume of that, which is going to come out in the series of Glenstall History volumes, which Four Courts Press publish. And my colleagues who are editing it with me are Dr. Brona McSheen from NUIG in Galway, and Brother Colmo Clobig, and brother Martin Brown, who have edited several volumes of the Glenstoddle Histories already. And I think Brides of Christ is going to be their fifth one. So we're looking forward to having that out towards the end of this year.
I attended the conference and I'm really excited and looking forward to obtaining my own copy of that book now. Glad that it's being published. Thank you so much, Tracy, for joining me today to talk about your book.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Tracy Collins' book, Female Monasticism in Medieval Ireland, an Archaeology, is available now through Cork University Press. If you'd like to hear more episodes, subscribe to New Books on Irish Studies on the New Books Network website, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Stitcher. Until next time, stay safe and keep reading.